Hi everybody, welcome to the Poetry Vlog. In today's episode, we'll talk with Stevie. Stevie, will you tell everyone what they should get out of today's episode?
Yeah, so in today's episode, we're going to find out if burlesque can be a form of feminist and queer poetics.
Yes, perfect, thank you. We dive into this book.
Striptease by Rachel Steyer.
And Stevie's incredibly amazing reader, so you're also going to get a little bit into how to better perform your poems out loud. And we actually do a segment of that in my classes, so
okay.
If you're in the class and we're in that segment, you already know what your homework is. If you're not in the class and you're just watching because you're curious, we have a call for comments below, and it's pinned at the top of the comments page, and we'll also tell you what they are at the end of the video. All right, ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
Bye, everybody. Enjoy. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Poetry Vlog. Today we have Stevie Costa with us. Stevie, will you introduce yourself?
Yeah. So, hello. I'm Dr. Stevie Costa. I teach at Cornish College of the Arts in UW-Bothell, but I am also a burlesque performer, and I run a small theater burlesque hybrid company. It's called Novelties Theater. That is a pun. It is novel. And then the word tease, not novelties, like, haha, this is fun. Although that too. So, so I have an active arts practice that has been totally running in parallel with my academic life for, like, ever.
Yeah. And where can people find you online?
So you can find me online if you want to read about teaching or any of my research work at steviecosta.com. That's steviecosta.com. And then if you want to find out more about Novelties, we're noveltiestheater.org, and that is NovelTease theater with an re.org.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And also I'd really encourage you to check it out because it's such a way to center what I think we're going to talk about today, which is basically like taking back burlesque and that type of arts practice as a very like feminist stance and a very like body positive stance too, is what I noticed. And then what I like about Novelties is there's that emphasis on like literary burlesque, basically.
Yeah. Totally.
So if you're a nerd, we'll talk about your like, your other personality.
Okay, sure.
It's like perfect. It's a marriage of all the things. Actually shout out to my friend Crystal, because I already know she's going to be, like, obsessed with your work once I put this outside.
Okay, out. So,
Crystal, you're going to really like this one. All right, so what did you bring to read today?
Yeah, so I brought a piece of a talking strip that was written and performed by Gypsy Rose Lee, OG Seattle stripper. For the rest of this, I will simply refer to her as Ms. Rose Lee to avoid saying her first name, because we all know that that's not a great word to say anymore, but it is, however, her name. And it's found in this book, Striptease, The Untold History of the Girly Show by Rachel Steyer. This is one of the most comprehensive histories of the girly show, or of a number of different forms of striptease over the years, that is currently published. And I'm hoping that some people will work on some more of these, because this does have some gaps and fissures, but it also has this beautiful poem, this talking strip that Ms. Rose Lee used to perform, called The Private Life of the Stripteaser. So here it is. Have you the faintest idea of the private life of a stripteaser? My dear, it's New York's second largest industry. Now, a stripteaser's education requires years of concentration, and for the sake of illustration, take a look at me. I began at the age of 3, learning ballet at the Royal Imperial School in Moscow, and how I suffered and suffered for my art. Then, of course, Sweetbriar, ah, those dear college days. And after 4 years of sociology, zoology, biology, and anthropology, my education was complete. And I was ready to make my professional debut on 14th Street. Now, the things that go on in a stripteaser's mind would give you no end of surprise. But if you're more psychologically inclined, there is more to see than meets the eye. For example, when I lower my gown a fraction and expose a patch of shoulder, I'm not interested in your reaction or in the bareness of that shoulder. I'm thinking of some paintings by Van Gogh or by Cezanne, or the charm I had in reading Lady Windermere's Fan. And when I lower the other side and expose my other shoulder, do you think I take the slightest pride in the whiteness of my shoulder? I'm thinking of my country house and the jolly fun in shooting grouse. And the frantic music changes, then off to my cue. But I only think of all the things I really ought to do. Wire Leslie Howard, cable Noel Coward, go to Bergdorf's for my fitting, buy the yarn for Mother's knitting, put preserves up by the jar, and make arrangements for my church bazaar. But here's the music, and that's my cue. There is only one thing left for me to do, so I do it. And when I raise my skirts with shyness and dexterity, I am mentally computing just how much I'll give to charity. Though my thighs I have revealed, and just a bit of me remains concealed, I'm thinking of the life of Duce, or the third chapter of The Last Puritan. None of these men whose minds are obscene, they leave me apathetic. I prefer the more aesthetic. Things like dramas by Racine, Gone with the Wind. And when I display my charms in all their dazzling splendor, and prove to you conclusively I am of the female gender, I'm really thinking of Elsie de Wolfe and the bric-a-brac I saw, and that lovely letter I received from Mr. Bernard Shaw. I have a townhouse on the East River because it's so fashionable to look at Welfare Island, coal barges, and garbage scows. I have a chinchilla, a Newport villa, and stand there shyly, with nothing on at all, clutching an old velvet drop and looking demurely at every man. Do you believe for a moment that I'm thinking of sex? Well, I certainly am.
Perfect. Thank you. I love how you read.
Thanks.
So actually, we're going to take a slight detour.
Yeah.
For the sake of, like, as you know, and students watching this know, it's actually really hard to read well, right? What are some of your hacks for how you read in that kind of personified voice?
Ooh, sure. Yeah. Well, I also do a little bit of voiceover work. Mm-hmm. So, parsing out where sentences actually begin and end is a useful tool. In advance, yeah. Looking over it, I'll usually mark up a script. And also thinking a little bit about, like, what words you want to emphasize.
Yeah.
This poem is so interesting because not all of it rhymes.
Yeah.
And depending on which accent you use to read it, sometimes it'll rhyme more than others. Like, there's supposed to be Cezanne and fan, but I pronounce it Cezanne.
Yeah.
As a choice, because I think that's how Ms. Rosalie would have actually pronounced it. Yeah. I don't think she would have done it.
And that's
in, like,
almost more coy as well,
yeah,
right? It's less nursery rhymey. It's
exactly
a little bit more like you're expecting a rhyme here.
But we're going to break it.
Right.
Exactly.
Which is actually a lot of how burlesque works.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. An expectation and a break, and then something a little, and the interplay of those reveals.
So you kind of mark up if you're going to inflect certain vowel sounds a certain way as well.
Mm-hmm. And then I also, which I'll usually do is I'll be like, if I were to mark it up, I would be like French accent on this word.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't use a more traditional vowel marking. And I also think a little bit about, like, where I'm going to put breaks and emphasis. And so if I want to add a pause, I will add a little pause there.
Yeah.
I think it's important to try and make it sound kind of natural, but also performed, because this is a performance piece. It is meant to be said and read aloud on the stage.
Say a student is going to read someone else's poem.
Mm-hmm.
How would you instruct them to go about trying to figure out the voice of that poem and how to read it?
Sure. Yeah, I think that's an interesting question, right? And this is actually, this is a good place to sort of talk about, like, the work that I do in literary burlesque, right? Like,
yes.
So I think that anytime that you're working with someone else's text, if you're going to perform somebody else's poem, it's not necessary to do it exactly as the originator would do it. But because today I'm giving you kind of an introduction to the kind of work that Ms. Rosalie used to do, I think it's important to try and preserve some of what her character would have been. And she and I, as performance personas, I think are actually somewhat similar in a similar tradition. I forgot her tagline, but I can tell you my tagline. So my stage name is Sailor St. Clair. I'm the showgirl scholar. And Ms. Rosalie was this sort of, you know, intellectualized version of this low-class stripper character, right?
So
that is what I also try to marry in my tagline, because I'm an academic and also a burlesque performer. And so I think that the way that she presented herself in the world, she would have had this awareness of being able to do that kind of language play, and so much of it is in that poem, this transition between, here's this high class thing I'm doing. I'm a classy lady, but I'm a stripper and I'm going to talk about Cezanne, but also my apartment is a garbage barge, right? Like that kind of thing. So that interplay between the highbrow and lowbrow is really important in this poem. And I think it's also important to maybe mix those pronunciations. And I could see the value of pronouncing it Cezanne, like in a very flat kind of thing.
Yeah. as like a sort of comedic, exaggerated refusal to pronounce it that way.
Yeah, and that could totally work too. That could totally work too, and I think is an absolutely valid interpretation of that poem. But I think you can also sort of mock that high class attitude by pronouncing it correctly and overly correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
Like not just Cezanne, but Cezanne with that extra draw that I do on the A.
Yeah.
So that's an intentional thing, like working on and against the text, right? And like, this is very much like germane to what I do in working in literary burlesque, where what my company and I are doing is creating these texts. We're adapting from novels or adapting from poetry. Yep. We are creating plays out of that and inserting burlesque into those texts.
Yeah.
That's
so cool.
Yeah, it works. I like to describe it to people as like it works like a musical, right? Where the song and dance numbers are in a musical, where they sort of diegetically carry something, or maybe they just stop for a moment of fun or release. We're doing that, but it's with dance and striptease.
Yeah.
And that's a very old genre. It predates Miss Rose Lee. That's actually, we're kind of reviving and working through something from the 1880s, but that's also working on and against the text. We are not just doing, we just did Adventures of Baron Munchausen in the spring.
Yeah.
That's a novel from 1785, and the second half of that book is very gross and colonial racism. We're just like, we're not going to do that. We're going to do the parts that are fun.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's kind of like a reparative way of reading as well.
Totally, right. And you can do that with things like this. Like, it's about working on or against the text in order to make it more appropriate or more relevant to a more queer or feminist
and
world.
And sometimes the most subversive thing you can do with a traditional text is read against its more...
Yeah.
problematic grains, because then it's refusing to give it that power of meaning making.
Totally.
So I really love that you all are picking that up, and she does that throughout the poem.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So you're doing these different plays, you're reading these different poems, and you're sort of camping up class, right? And you're sort of camping out literariness.
Yeah.
Right? While also playing with it. Why burlesque?
Why burlesque?
Yes. Why do you want to talk about burlesque today? Because otherwise we'd be like, well, I don't see why there has to be stripteasing involved.
Yeah. Right? Well, I think this is a good question to answer a little bit historically. So I mentioned that literary burlesque is an old genre, and it comes from the 1880s, and I'll talk a little bit about that history and sort of give you these super-duper cliffs notes of like, the history that Rachel Steyer gives you at length in this.
I'm like, here we go, buckle your kiddos.
So in the 1869, the very first burlesque troupe came over to the United States. That's Lydia Thompson and her British Blondes, and what they were doing were... plays. They were taking classical drama, things like Ixion or like stuff by Sophocles, and then rewriting it to poke fun and satirize the political conditions of the day. And they were all women. There was no striptease, but they kind of maybe like wore tights, and that was super racy. And then that genre lasted for maybe 20 years, and by that time, by like the end of the 1880s, people weren't doing plays anymore. They were doing like these ballet reviews, what we call leg shows, to get into the girly shows. So the text kind of fell away.
Yeah, yeah.
And that quickly became, around the turn of the 20th century, that's when striptease started to enter into it, you know, in a more fully realized way.
Yeah.
So some of the history of the genre, like it changed in response to social conditions, like as the end of the 19th century became slightly more liberal. You didn't have to like make sexy jokes in the context of real theater. You could just have a sort of sexy show. But then there are people like Miss Rose Lee who sort of dove back into that older form of the genre, doing these talking strips, and there are a few other artists who did them. And I think that's really interesting in terms of what this genre is, because it's always been a female-driven genre. And so I am interested in this as a genre, I think, because of its long history of camp, and also because it's always been a space that is primarily created for and by women, and that the primary voices or the primary bodies that are claiming that space are primarily female and other identities that wrap themselves up into that sort of feminist coding.
Perfect.
So I love that about it. And that's something that I've always loved. Also because, you know, academia is not that.
No,
you know, and so it's
it like
nice.
Wants to be that so
it tries.
Bad.
It tries,
but like it doesn't quite.
And so you can talk like you can talk a good game, right? Like you can sit in a room and like talk feminist theory all day, but if you're not making that connection, I think, to feminist practice, that was something that I was missing, and this is why when I went to graduate school, and I have a very good friend who is a company member in Novelties with me.
Yeah.
She's the modern sexual intellectual, so she's also very much in this tradition. But we both like went to grad school and started doing burlesque at the same time because we were like,
you needed like a physical space to perform and work out the different types of meanings that you're making.
Exactly. And like to embody that fury, right? And to embody the kinds of stories that we were learning to tell.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that academia is missing a lot of the time.
Why do you think this is a feminist moment and thing to do when oftentimes people would say, oh, but you're still kind of like playing into the male gaze or like being objectified by the male gaze? And when, I know you're going to answer this really well, but I'm going to plug, if you can, tying it in with the poem rigs. I think some of the answers are in that.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So I'll answer this for both, like, I like to do this with burlesque where I like to talk about that like 1880s as being adjacent to kind of now, because I think that's actually true. So as I was describing earlier, this genre really changed. And the genre as it started was not performed for male audiences. When it was theater and treated like theater, and I sort of have a little like chip on my shoulder about this because I do feel the theater community does not treat burlesque like theater, which is what I am trying to change. Because I'm literally writing plays. That is theater. But so when it was in this more like diegetic play format.
And also how convenient that it's not considered theater when it's not mostly cis male
performance. Yes, what do you know?
Sidebar.
Isn't that interesting?
Surprise!
Isn't that interesting? It was considered theater though in the late 19th century. And people would, of any gender, would go, right?
Yeah.
Like, men and their wives, or groups of young women, or groups of young men, or couples would go to the theater, and they would go to these burlesque plays, and it was very common for anybody to go. That really changed in the early 20th century, and that has a lot to do with moral codes, that has a lot to do with vice laws, that has a lot to do with Mayor LaGuardia in New York City, which is its own other story. But it just, it has to do with like this moment where at the beginning of the 20th century, burlesque became more associated more clearly with sex work. And it was, right? Like the women that we talk about who did striptease in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, they were sex workers. That's what that was at that time. It is not necessarily considered that now. There's a lot of discussion in our community if burlesque is actually sex work or sex work adjacent. And I think there are so many performers who, in fact, are also sex workers that it doesn't feel right for the rest of us who are not to say that we are.
Yeah.
But that's where that kind of overlap happens.
Okay,
and that question I think that you were asking about, like, well, is this feminist if it was done for a male audience? And the answer is it wasn't originally, and it certainly isn't now.
Perfect.
But there was a time in which, because of its associations with sex work, which is constructed as for a male audience, which, like,
that's a whole other debate.
It's not, but, you know.
For the record, we're both like, no.
Yeah. Lots of people need the services of sex workers, and those people and those clients are not necessarily always male. So that's like a larger cultural problem.
Yeah.
But because this was revived in the 1990s, primarily by women who were sex workers, who were club workers, they were like, you know what? I want to do something that's just for me. Like, I go here every night to this club, and I put on this little skimpy outfit, and I dance for all these guys, and I make money, and that's great. But what if I could dance as Godzilla? Wouldn't that be awesome?
So
they were starting to look back at this older genre where they could do stuff like that. And have a space to feel that they were creative outside of the confines of the male gaze. And other sex workers went to those shows. And then their friends who were females went to those shows. And then their gay friends went to those shows. And so that changed the way that this is perceived. So it's really a feminist self-making practice. It's a textual revision practice.
It's been like a sort of reclamation of an art
form.
So like similar to how like queer, the easy example always is the word queer, right? Like
right.
I went from being a slam to being something that like people pick up.
And
then I'm going to, just for the sake of time, quickly, I wanted to connect to the poem, because what I love about that ending, which I'm sure is part of why you read it, is that's like a prime example of how both the text on the page language and her performed language is literally reclaiming her subjectivity and what she deems as like sexy or sexual. Because then it's like, why is it not thinking of sex when you're thinking about all these other things at the same time.
Right. So I brought you a set of
bookmarks.
So my company, so Novelties, we have these.
I love how you fan it.
Very. Yes. So these are just like, these are our business cards.
God,
we have these
beautiful
bookmarks that we did of each of us. This is actually not a full set. I'm sorry, Trixie. I didn't know where yours was this morning, but I brought these for you. So this is almost everybody.
Yay! And people can get these from your website?
They can get them at our shows,
perfect.
But this is also very convenient for you because
like
here is the website. So
perfect.
If you want to like zoom in on that.
Also, these are like really amazing.
Yeah, these are great.
Cool.
So we're just in there subverting your whole reading experience.
For the podcast listeners, you'll send me some images I can put up on the screen so people can
absolutely.
See it
perfectly.
These are so rad. I want to create like a little... and also it showcases the different types of subjectivities that can do the work.
Totally.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Podcast listeners, if you follow the links in the description, you'll find all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
YouTube viewers, you already saw those images pop up, but there's still links to all of this in the description. People forget about that. If you're watching on a phone, you have to press the arrow to look down and find all the links. And we're wrapping up. So thank you for tuning in. As a quick reminder, Stevie, where can people find you?
So I'm at steviecosta.com. That's StevieCosta. And my company, Novelties Theater, is at NovelTease theater with an re.org.
Perfect. And hopefully by the end of this video, you've learned how burlesque can be a feminist, queer, actually like multiple sexuality and sex
mm-hmm.
identifiers,
totally.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Space to kind of lean into different ways of performing. Right. So what I'd like to hear in the call for comments below is what your experience with burlesque is in a feminist or queer space. And if you haven't had one, what barriers have been in the way from going to one before,
mm-hmm.
actually.
Yeah.
Because I think, like, I didn't even know about this until, like, a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I've been pretty active in the queer community
mm-hmm.
since, like, for at least 6 or 7 years. It isn't that long, but I'm young, so.
Yeah.
You know? And then I went to her and I was like, whoa, it, like, blew my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to hear from everyone else.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
What your relationship to that is.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's age, right? Like, this is age restrictive.
Yeah.
So I understand for maybe younger viewers, this is probably not something that you can see in person until you are probably 21, because it's in a lot of bars. 18, if you're cool like us, because we try to do 18 plus shows.
Yeah.
Since it's theater. And then, you know, there's also a ton of burlesque on YouTube. So if you just like YouTube Burlesque Hall of Fame, you can watch some of the best in burlesque.
And we'll link to Stevie's own videos, right?
Yeah.
If that's cool with you.
Yeah.
Check all of that stuff out. And then remember, if you're listening to the podcast, you can go to the website to find all of the links to the YouTube channel, Instagram, Twitter, and the newsletter. And of course, like and subscribe. So I think that's it.
Great.
Thanks again, Stevie.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was really great.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.